Welcome to the History Podcast, an educational podcast intended to engage student learning and also engage those history fans who just love American history. Without further delay, let's get to it. Welcome to the podcast. Today we're going to be talking about the presidency of Harry S. Truman. Truman is going to take over in 1945 after the death of FDR. FDR dies from complications of polio in April of that year. And as Vice President, Harry S. Truman has to assume the office, and he's going to assume the office in a critical point of the war. The island hopping campaign has been successful, and now the last stop on the mission is Japan. U.S. troops are ready to invade Japan on the command of the President of the United States, and Harry S. Truman is now faced not only with the task of becoming the President of the United States, but immediately upon being sworn in, he is being presented by his military advisors the different options on an invasion of Japan. He is given four options. Number one, we continue the conventional bombing of Japanese cities. Number two, we just invade Japan the old-fashioned traditional way. Or number three, we demonstrate the bomb on an unpopulated island, sending a warning that they need to surrender immediately. Or number four, we drop the bomb on an inhabited Japanese city. I cannot imagine the gravity of that decision. We have just successfully tested the bomb in New Mexico, where upon the atomic bomb exploding, the sand in the desert immediately turned to glass. The world has never seen a bomb like this. But we are at a juncture where a decision has to be made. And Truman weighs the option. His advisors say if we go the traditional way, we're probably going to lose hundreds of thousands of American soldiers by the time it's all said and done, based upon the mentality of the Japanese soldier. Or we drop the bomb, and there's no telling how many lives will be lost because we've never dropped a bomb of this magnitude before. Truman, weighing the options, deciding that American lives were more valuable, he decides to drop the atomic bomb on inhabited cities. In August of 1945, Harry S. Truman will give the order to drop the atomic bomb. When the bomb explodes at Hiroshima, the temperature near the blast site reached somewhere in the ballpark of 5,400 degrees Fahrenheit. The sky seemed to explode with that mushroom cloud. Birds ignited in midair. Asphalt boiled. People for over 2 miles away burst into crumbling cinders. Others who were near the bomb, who didn't die instantaneously from the blast, had raw skin hanging in flaps around their hips. Men lost their feet and were stumbling about on the charred stumps of their ankles. Other accounts talked about how women without jaws screamed incoherently for help. One witness described the bodies as boiled octopuses littered in the destroyed streets. According to one eyewitness at Hiroshima, they said, "I climbed the hill and looked down, I saw that Hiroshima had disappeared. I was shocked by the sight. Of course, I saw many dreadful scenes after that, but that experience, looking down and finding nothing left of Hiroshima, was so shocking that I simply can't express what I felt. Hiroshima didn't exist. That was mainly what I saw. Hiroshima didn't exist. The body count of the initial bomb left many dead. Approximately 80,000 people were killed as a direct result, and somewhere in the ballpark of 35,000 were injured. 60,000 additionally would probably die within the next year due to long-term exposure to the atomic bomb. Finally, 1 week later, on August 14th, 1945, after Truman had to drop a second bomb, after pleading with the Japanese to surrender, he had to drop that second bomb at Nagasaki. After that bomb, the Japanese finally surrendered. In World War II, the deadliest conflict in human history, where somewhere between 50 and 85 million fatalities had finally come to an end with the surrender of the Empire of Japan. And I can't even imagine the level of stress that Truman was thrust into as President of the United States. The apex of World War II was right in front of him. And he had to make the decision. And it's a decision that we look back historically and we can debate the morality and the ethics of the decision. And that is certainly fair. But in that moment, I can't imagine what decision I would have made. And it's easy to sit in hindsight and to say we would have done that or this or the other, but in the moment, you're days into the office, an office that you never anticipated assuming, and you've got to make that decision. Nonetheless, the war is over. And Truman, along with his close advisors, are going to have to determine how the United States is going to move forward in trying to help rebuild Europe after it has been ravaged through over the last 5 to 6 years, from 39 to 45. In 1947, Truman will introduce his presidential doctrine, known historically as the Truman Doctrine. He will address the joint session of Congress on March 12, 1947, to address a recent announcement by the British Prime Minister, Winston Churchill, who said as of March 31st, they would no longer provide military aid or economic aid to the government of Greece, who was in the midst of a civil war with the Greek Communist Party. Truman will address those statements before Congress, and he will say that the United States will support Greece against the communist, and that he wants Congress to approve those measures in order to provide aid not only to Greece, but also to Turkey, who is also in harm's way with communists in that region looking to take over the Turkish government. And both of those countries had previously relied on the support of Great Britain, who had recently come out and said, economically, we're not in a state to help. You guys are on your own, essentially. The support he was requesting was to provide $400 million in aid to those countries, and also to support sending American civilians, and military personnel and equipment into the area if need be. The Truman Doctrine established that the United States would provide political, military, and economic assistance to any nation who promoted democratic ways of life, who were under the threat of communist takeover. The Truman Doctrine, and this is important, the Truman Doctrine will transform American foreign policy moving forward. In the past, we were more focused on one particular nation. But now we are focused on promoting an ideal: capitalism, democracy, and combating communism with this doctrine is important to President Truman. As a part of the Truman Doctrine is this idea of containment. Now, the containment policy, which was developed by George Kennan, a career Foreign Service officer, became Truman's public foreign policy. And if we're being frank, every administration that follows Truman during the Cold War uses some form of containment. The containment policy is going to be the strategy for dealing with the Soviet Union during the Cold War. Kennan will argue the main element of any U.S. policy toward the Soviet Union must be that of a long-term, patient, but firm and vigilant containment of Russian expansive tendencies. Now, not everybody was on board with Kennan's plan. It was heavily criticized, especially by Republicans, but it was heavily criticized because the policy failed to differentiate between vital and peripheral U.S. interests. Another criticism was the policy was too defensive. The U.S. policy should be to roll back the Soviets and specifically liberate Eastern Europe. In spite of criticism, Kennan's policy remained the strategy of the United States. Throughout the Cold War, the United States did not retreat into isolationism as it had done before. It did it after World War I. It did it before World War I. It did it after World War I, and it did it leading into World War II. But as I mentioned, every succeeding president moving forward during the Cold War will use some variation, some form of the containment policy as their own. From Truman to Eisenhower, to Kennedy, to LBJ, to Nixon, to Ford, and even Carter and Reagan. Containment would be the new American foreign policy. A critical component of the Truman administration after World War II was to help rebuild Europe. Europe was completely destroyed by war, making it very susceptible to internal and external threats of communism. And on June 5th, 1947, the Secretary of State, George Marshall, a guy who was FDR's close confidant during the early years of the war and now is serving as such for the new president, Harry S. Truman, gave a graduation address at Harvard University where he called for a comprehensive program to rebuild Europe. He was playing off this fear of Soviet expansion, and he knew that Congress was listening. And this plan led Congress, this speech rather, at Harvard, led Congress to pass a bill known historically as the Economic Cooperation Act. We historically know it as the Marshall Plan. This bill would provide funding to rebuild Europe, eventually raising, by the time we get to 1948, upwards of $12 billion, with a B, dollars sent to Europe to rebuild European industries and to stimulate the American economy. The Marshall Plan was recognized historically as a tremendous humanitarian effort, And later on, Marshall would receive a Nobel Peace Prize for his efforts. But another really important part of the Marshall Plan is how it is going to shape future foreign policy in the country. What we see from the Marshall Plan is how it establishes foreign aid as an integral part of U.S. foreign policy moving forward. A topic, mind you, that is heavily debated in 2019 as to how much foreign aid should be given to countries. But it really starts here with the Marshall Plan. A part of the containment policy that Truman will have to deal with is the Korean conflict. And for the purposes of this podcast, we're mainly focused on Truman's administration and things that happen within his administration. But to summarize, the Korean conflict will take place from 50 to 53. And we will push north of the 38th parallel before the Chinese hop in. After warning us not to come any further, we retreat past the 38th parallel. And we eventually come to what is known as a truce or an armistice. And the 38th parallel is going to divide North and South Korea even to this day. And they will establish a demilitarized zone there at the 38th parallel, which will divide the two countries. But the purposes of talking about the Korean conflict in this podcast is to discuss criticism that Truman is going to face for not going further. The Chinese warned us not to go any further than the Yulu River. We did, and when we did, they jumped in and we retreated back. And Truman is going to be criticized for essentially pulling the plug there and accepting the truce in 1953, where the dividing line between North and South Korea is at the 38th parallel. One of his largest critics is the iconic general, Douglas MacArthur. MacArthur wanted to invade China with forces and was very open about his criticism that Truman did not want to. He denounced the president's policies with relation to Korea and said that we should be invading China and that Truman looked weak by not invading China. Now, in most cases, this would not be an issue at all. The president would just come in and fire that general for going against his policies publicly, for being insubordinate of those policies. But this is not some general. This is a World War II hero, the man who is given credit for the island-hopping campaign in World War II. He's also a guy that's had his fair share of black eyes, one of those being the Bonus Army March that he took tanks and ran through their camps, removing World War I veterans from government lawns while they were protesting for their bonus that they were promised during the Great Depression. But he is a very popular general. And in modern day, we don't typically idolize our generals like we did back then. But this guy had his own ticker tape parade after World War II. That's how iconic he is. It wasn't for a group of soldiers, it was for him alone. And Truman has just fired this man. Truman has just given him his packing papers. And the public is split over this. The public views MacArthur as a hero, and they cannot believe that this president, this guy who assumed the office because of death, this guy from Missouri that no one really even knows who he is, just fired one of our most iconic, heroic generals in American history, because he got his feelings hurt, is the way they see it. Now, there were those veterans who actually supported Truman because they said, you know what, we're not saying we disagree with what he said. We disagree that he said it publicly, that he was insubordinate. That's not how we do things in the military. Nonetheless, Truman stands by his firing, but he takes a lot of backlash for the firing of Douglas MacArthur. After the World War ends, there is tremendous fear that the Communist Party is going to rise up and jeopardize our government. And we've talked about the Red Scare in previous podcasts. We talked about the first wave in the 1920s and how it led to a lot of actions that are uncharacteristic in normal times. And we're going to see the same thing apply in the second wave of the Red Scare when Whitaker Chambers, a member of the Communist Party in the United States and a Soviet spy who had recently renounced communism and became a really outspoken opponent of this ideology. He's going to testify before the HUAC, which HUAC stands for the House on Un-American Activities. He's going to testify in 1948 in front of HUAC. And in front of HUAC, he is going to allege and identify several persons, including a man by the name of Alger Hiss. Hiss had once served in the FDR administration. And he's going to identify these guys as members of the Communist Party. Obviously, Hiss is going to vehemently deny this, and eventually he's going to sue Chambers for libel. But he's questioned by HUAC, and they catch him in some lies. And later in 1949, they're going to convict him on perjury, and they're going to sentence him to prison. One of the members on this committee is a future president of the United States. His name, Richard Nixon, from California. At this time, he's a very young Republican from the state of California. And he's been working with a man by the name of Senator Joseph McCarthy, a Republican from the state of Wisconsin. And McCarthy is going to capitalize on this fear that is spreading throughout the country. He's going to use the Hiss conviction to make his appearance on the national stage, to get people and capture people's attention. While speaking at an engagement in Wheeling, West Virginia on February 9th, 1950, McCarthy is going to make a claim that he has a list of 205 card-carrying members of the Communist Party, and he waves this list in his hand. And these communist members are working in the United States Department of the State. This is going to set off an era of paranoia, where you're going to see accusation after accusation after accusation against many Americans in the government, the army, which is going to end up being McCarthy's downfall, the motion picture industry, literary figures, intellectuals, and other areas of society. Anyone that may have had any connection in any way, formal or informal, directly or indirectly, was going to be viewed as a potential communist spy. One of the things that we don't talk about a lot are the Venona cables. Now, the Venona cables were communications that were sent from Soviet agents that were in the United States during this period of time to Moscow. Now, these are going to be intercepted by U.S. intelligence, but they're not going to be released to the public until the mid-1990s, so decades after they were intercepted. And in these cables, these Venona cables, as we know them historically, these cables seem to identify an Alice, which many believe was code for Alger Hiss. And they identify Alger Hiss as a Soviet agent and also confirm Julius Rosenberg. The Rosenbergs, as you know, were Julius and Ethel were convicted of giving the Soviets the atomic secrets. They were convicted and tried and then eventually executed, or tried, convicted, and executed. And in these cables, it seems to confirm Julius's part in that, but it does not clearly state Ethel's guilt. But these Venona cables give further credence to some of the accusations that McCarthy made during this period of time. It does not validate the claim of the 205 card-carrying members that he claimed that he had working within the State Department. During this Red Scare, during this time of tremendous fear in the United States, Congress is going to pass the National Security Act of 1947. Truman will sign it into law, and this will allow for major reorganization of U.S. foreign policy and military machinery. This bill will create the National Security Council, where American foreign policy and military moves are planned, and members of this military council include the President of the United States, his Vice President, the Secretary of State, the Secretary of Defense, the Chairman, and the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and the Director of the CIA. This is where we get the National Security Council. Is in 1947, signed into law by then President Harry S. Truman. After World War II ended, as a part of the Yalta Conference, where the big three met, FDR, Stalin, and Churchill, they met to determine what they were going to do with Germany after the war was over, and they all agreed at the time that they would split Germany up into four zones. One would belong to the United States, the other to the British, the other to the Soviets, and then the fourth would belong to the French. These were known as occupation zones. Berlin, Germany, a major city in Germany, was far inside Soviet-controlled East Germany. However, the United States, Great Britain, and France controlled western parts of the city, while the Soviets controlled the eastern part. And this is where the conflict kind of begins with Berlin. In 1948, the Soviets did not want the Westerners helping in Berlin. They didn't want their assistance. They didn't want their aid. They wanted them to rely upon the Soviet Union. And so what they did was they created a blockade in Berlin on all rail, on road, and water access to the Allied controlled areas of Berlin. They didn't want the Allies assisting in Berlin anymore. This does not go over well with the United States and Great Britain, who have militaries at the ready, but that's not what they want. They don't want a military conflict, and so instead, they're going to use their militaries to airlift food and fuel to Berlin from bases in the western part of Germany, the democratic side of Germany. As these planes fly low over eastern Berlin and western Berlin, Berliners are able to receive food and supplies that they need in order to survive on a daily basis. And in May of 1949, the Soviets will lift that blockade because it's quite frankly unsuccessful. And the only way that you're going to be able to stop it is to do so by force, and that's just not what they want to do. They don't want to bark up that tree with the United States. What will come of this is the establishment of East and West Germany. It will also recognize Berlin as kind of the symbol of freedom and democracy in the fight against communism. And lastly, this will lead to the creation of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, also known by its acronym as NATO. NATO is the first peacetime military alliance that the United States has ever entered into outside of the Western Hemisphere. And it was formed in response to Soviet threats in the region. But I think what's more important is that it is an example of the increased role and responsibility that the United States now feels as the world's first superpower. This is a new role. And we've talked about the ascension of the United States as a world power. 1898, we defeat the Spanish in the Spanish-American War, and we are a world power after that conflict. Fast forward to 1914 to 1918, we get involved in World War I at the very tail end of the war, 1917 to 18. And after that war, we move from a debtor nation to a creditor nation, meaning nations across the globe, primarily Great Britain and France, owe us billions of dollars. But after World War II, we become the world's first superpower. And that role comes with humongous challenges and hurdles. But when you're the first, you've got to navigate your way through it. And we don't want to go into this alone. And that's why the North Atlantic Treaty Organization is important to the United States and to Truman. Because this is a military alliance that hopefully will help contain the spread of communism, and we won't have to do it alone. ...1948 is election season, and Truman is going to have the opportunity to try and win his first elected term. Now remember, he took over for FDR in 1945 after FDR's death. And so this would be his first victory if he could pull it off. The problem is, he is a major underdog in this election, and there's many reasons why. Democrats have been in office for quite some time. FDR has won four straight terms leading up to this point. This would be the fifth if Truman won. And there's this sentiment that America is ready to just have a change. Number two, Truman's doctrine is not super popular with the American public. We are spending billions of dollars trying to rebuild Europe, a task and a job that the American people just quite frankly don't believe is our responsibility. And number three, there are multiple third-party candidates that could potentially take away from Truman's electoral votes. The Democratic Party at this time is kind of going through a little bit of a split. You have the Roosevelt Democrats who support Truman for the most part. But the Southern Democrats are opposed to another term of Truman. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that Truman has openly talked about civil rights issues. And I've mentioned this in my classes before, but I just believe that as time goes on, Harry S. Truman is going to get more credit for being a civil rights president than he does currently, because he was talking about these issues in an era where it was not popular to do so. And I think we give a lot of credit to guys like Kennedy and LBJ, but we oftentimes skip over Truman. Truman desegregates the military, and he has also hinted at integration in society. Problem for Truman is he doesn't have the traction to do it at this point in time. You have a Southern blockade in Congress who refuses to even entertain the idea. And Southern Democrats in general are not okay with the thought of a Truman presidency anymore. They don't want Truman to win his own term. They want Truman out of there. They see him as an accidental president who only got the job because FDR died, and they want him gone, and they want a Southern sympathizer in the White House who's going to protect segregation and Jim Crow laws and black codes. And the man they're going to nominate is a man by the name of Strom Thurmond from the state of South Carolina. You have another branch, if you will, of the Democratic Party. It's the progressive candidate. But he has a history of Democratic politics, and his name is Henry A. Wallace, who was the former vice president of FDR in his third term. They dropped Wallace strategically to put Truman on the ticket because of polling reasons. They felt like Truman could help them get some states like his home state of Missouri and the surrounding states where FDR had kind of been struggling in polling. And there's some bad blood there because Wallace does not agree with Truman's approach to the Soviets. And when you look at the electoral college, he doesn't make a dent. He doesn't get one single electoral vote. But in the popular vote, he actually gets 1.1 million votes. So he does do some damage. And you would think that based on that information and based on what you know about third-party politics, that Truman had no chance whatsoever. And so did every other media outlet in the country. In fact, newspapers were so confident on election day in 1948, they went to bed early. They printed the headlines early before the results came in with the headlines captioning, "Dewey defeats Truman." And they went to bed early. They called it a night. Only to wake up the next morning with that oh crap moment. Truman, in probably the largest upset in American history, defeats Dewey. Dewey was so confident that he was going to win the election that he didn't even campaign that hard. He had like a front porch campaign as opposed to Truman, who did a whistle-stop tour across the country trying to hit as many major cities as he possibly could along the way. And he pulls off the upset. And one of my favorite pictures that I've ever owned is a photo of Harry S. Truman holding up the newspaper that says, "Dewey defeats Truman." And the smile on Truman's face says a million words. The excitement of victory is one thing, but the excitement of an upset victory is something that only a few can understand. And Harry S. Truman, from Missouri, as they like to say, wins the election of 1948, winning his own term, and he will serve that term under some rough conditions, as we've already talked about the Korean conflict. He'll have to fire one of the most iconic generals in American history. He will not seek another term after 52. One cool thing is that we've already done a podcast on the 22nd Amendment, which limits presidents to two elected terms. That's going to be ratified during this election cycle of 1948. But to show you how divisive the issue of race is in the country, as we kind of close this podcast, Truman's going to win the state of Tennessee, surprisingly. But one of the electors is going to cast his vote for Thurmond. The issue of race is one that has been avoided by the American government for a long time. but we are moving into an era where it can no longer be ignored. Truman makes this the fifth consecutive presidential election for the Democratic Party. It's the longest streak we've seen to this point since the six-term streak by the Republicans, starting with Lincoln and ending with Garfield. I do think as we close that Truman's administration is one that will always be criticized for things like the atomic bomb, for his firing of Douglas MacArthur. But when you consider that Truman took over when he did, and you consider who he replaced, there's an old adage that you don't replace a legend. You replace the guy who replaced the legend. And you just don't follow a legend. FDR won four consecutive terms for a reason, whether you like him or not. And for Truman to be the one that follows him the way he had to follow him, in the context of what was going on during World War II, I'd say he did pretty well. And I think as time passes, we will look back on the Truman administration as one that was efficient, that made tough decisions during tough times, and that advanced and transformed American foreign policy forever. Next time, we're going to talk about the administration of Dwight D. Eisenhower. World War II hero and icon is coerced into running, despite not having any interest, and he will win convincingly in 1952, and we will discuss his administration and more in the next episode. I hope that you've learned something, even if it's just one thing. I hope that you'll take it with you. I hope that you'll like the episode and give us some feedback, good or bad. We use that. We learn from that. We're always trying to get better at doing these podcasts, so please feel free to give us any kind of feedback. Please subscribe to the podcast so that anytime we push out a new episode, you get a notification that the podcast episode is available. I want to thank you for joining us. And as always, guys, those who don't know history are doomed to repeat it. We'll see you next time.